Well, love to see you here this morning. For me, it's the first time I've been back on campus since February, and so it's fun to work together on 9 o'clock for the rest of the week together. And I, of course, assume from, I think this is my 13th time at at Holden, that every day is different, and some people love to hike one day and be here the next day and so on. So thanks for your being here now. I'd like to talk a little bit about how this week is going to unfold for me and anybody with me. By and large, the summer has been under the vision of a couple of texts, and we've been calling them Jubilee texts. So we're going to do probably about half of each session on Jubilee, and I won't even tell you what we think that means yet. However, I'm much more interested as a scholar and a person to have us think through spirituality in relationship to the earth. And so about half of each session, we're going to be working on a very particular kind of spirituality here at Holden. That is, I'm going to have us ask earth questions in a spiritual way about what is happening basically in the Cascade Mountains, and to ask, for us to ask, what would be the equivalent of God questions, us questions, and see how that, what that brings to us in terms of not simply something that we just know, but as something that we feel and directs us. So in other words, each morning I'm going to talk about what is a strange ancient custom in mainly Hebrew tradition, and another half of the time about the Cascade Mountains and who they are in relationship to God, us, and the rest of the world. I want to think about that just a little bit more, because one of the beauties of this week here is we have a lot of folks talking and thinking about the earth and ecology and environmentalism. And so I am very interested in being close to their work as well, but I'm mainly a theologian and a biblical scholar, and I will try to walk alongside of that other course in ways that are particular to who I am. Finally, I think I want to say this, that if you think I'm going to give you a lecture, you're wrong. I've found that in my many decades of doing scholarship, that I do better when I'm talking with you, and they do better because I've listened and thought better. So I will probably not talk more than 10 minutes at a time. So I'm eager for you to be ready to protest about what I've said, to think deeper about what I've said, and to ask questions about what I've said. So just a little bit more then about both of the directions I'm going in. I will want to start with the closest, meaning the Cascades. And by about halfway through, I'll switch over to the the Jubilee section. I've got a lot of papers out here. I'll tell you when I'm using some. I, by and large, don't read from papers much, but interact with what I've got on pages. So we'll go about that way. Anytime you want to grab any of that, the better. I'll say one thing that will not be talked about much all week long, but I commend this material to you, which is the Shmita Project Northwest Congregational Partnership. Now, this is what my colleagues in the other class are going to be doing quite a bit about. So leave that there and pick this up whenever you'd like to in the week, because there'll be, of course, clearly more people coming in different days. So let's get the main thing that I want to be talking about in terms of the Cascade Mountains, God, and the Earth. There has been in the last probably 50 years some amazing biological studies that have come forth, many actually from Washington State. So I find myself, I'm going to be talking a fair amount, first of all, about one of the biggest biological discoveries, I think, of our day, most of which happened in Washington State on Olympic Peninsula. What that does is have us look at what's called keystone species. Keystone species. This is all on the far right paper here. But keystone species has been a discovery of biologists in the last 50 years. And again, mostly in Seattle and on the Olympic Peninsula. And that has had to do with sea otters. Anybody know about sea otters in Washington State? Well, anyway, so we'll be talking about that this morning, not because I think that they are in the Cascade Mountains, but because we've been learning now recently, in the past 20 years, a whole bunch about animals in the Cascade Mountains because of what world biologists have discovered about the otters, the sea otters. It turns out that this word, keystone species, has anyone ever heard that word? Ha ha, good, too, thanks. So a keystone species is really something that has been discovered in the last 50 years, in which it turns out that there are a whole bunch of different places where all kinds of plants and animals are, and that are greatly different because of what is called keystone species, meaning there are certain specific species that changes everybody. So what we found out, and we'll say this a little bit more in a minute, what we found out about the sea otters all up and down the west coast of North and South America. What we found out about that has changed and is beginning to change mightily all of the west coast, not just for otters, but for fish and all kinds of different species, as well as how the air works with the water. It's really funny and quite fascinating that sea otters changed most everything on the East Coast a long time ago and now. The main thing that happens in terms of sea otters is we don't know quite where sea otters started, but they have been a worldwide species, or at least a Pacific-wide species, for at least 6 million years. And for some reason, by about 4 million years ago, we're pretty sure that most of the sea otters, probably 3 million of them, lived mainly on the west coast of North and South America. Until the 1700s, in which humans discovered how amazing sea otters were. It turns out that they're really, really smart. And for one weird thing, they are the warmest animal of all mammals. And that's because they have lived mainly in really cold water. And they have, over those 6 million years, they have together put together the warmest fur in the world. Now, who cares? I'll tell you who cares. At first, it was the species of, the humans in Asia and where there was a lot of cold weather. So it turned out that many of the people and cultures of Asia East, Asia West, depending how we see it, were really cold. And they basically started in the 1700s throwing their boats towards the western coast of North America, in which at that point we know more or less, we know that there were at least 300,000 sea otters up and down the west coast. By the time that those cultures and the North American culture got through with them in the mid-20th century, there were hardly any sea otters. In other words, they had taken them all for their coats. And so, by and large, in, say, 1930 or 1940, both Russian and Chinese and American folks saw what had been done and started working on how they might undo it. Most everybody, after the first 20 years, says, we don't have a chance. And then they found out one thing. There were just a few otters, sea otters, left in Alaska and a little bit down along the coast of what we would call Washington State. They think maybe about 50 sea otters in Washington State from the millions. And so what happened was they discovered that the sea otter was this kind of species, this kind of keystone species. In other words, they didn't quite know what this would do, but when they got some more species, I think that was about 60, otters, when they found about 60 sea otters in Alaska and brought them to Washington State, within less than a year, the environment had changed just because of the otters. And here's the short version of it. What they've found is as the sea otters disappeared from the Washington State area, the ocean itself changed. And that was because what happened was the urchins in that part of the sea started eating under the water the main aspects of what we would call the forest under the sea. Mainly the fact that in those oceans they had beautiful forests, mostly of kelp. I'm not going to tell you exactly about kelp, but kelp basically made a home for many, many kinds of fish and other kinds of plants. But the urchins, when there were no otters, ate up all the kelp. And it was a kind of a desert under the sea. This happened all the way down. And was the same in California and Mexico and the like. Weird thing happened. When the 60 extra otters came to Washington State, it started eating the urchins. I mean, they say now that sea otters eat half of their weight every day. And they just loved urchins. Within the first year in Washington State, the kelp was flourishing again. And forests under the sea were attracting all kinds of fish and other animals. And all kinds of other fish that I don't even know the names for. This is now happening up and down North America and into South America. And to a certain extent, for once, it looks like we might say that humans had a part in it. In other words, getting those 60 otters from up in Alaska made a big difference, and then they started putting the otters the sea otters down the coast. Right now in California, there people are just sea otter crazy. They're so cute, for one thing. They're so smart. And they're actually really kind of mean in eating so much stuff. So this is a keystone species. What I want to do for the rest of the semester of this time together is not talk about these keystone species in the Olympic Peninsula, but the keystone species in the Cascade Mountains. So it turns out in the last 20 years we've found the key species some key species of the Cascade Mountains. Let me see if I can pop that on. No, I can't. Here we go. Okay. Here are five of the keystone species, you'll see how much I'm lying, because I'm not really a biologist. But I've been studying this for most of the summer because this is what I think we might do in the Cascade Mountains ourselves in Holden Village. So this is the anybody know what this is?
Snowshoe hare. I call it like a snowshoe hare.
Yeah, a snowshoe hare. Exactly. A snowshoe hare. It turns out, I'm not telling you how today, it turns out the snowshoe hare has much to do with life in the Cascade Mountains, especially for all of the other plants and animals. I'm going to ask us to think clearly, I might say, in terms of spirituality, in terms of divinity, what it means to live with snowshoe hares. Anybody know this one?
Gray wolf.
Gray wolf, exactly. Now, I hope some of you would argue how many gray wolves there are in Washington State, for instance, or in the Cascade Mountains. I've been studying this most of the summer, and it turns out that a lot of people have not really paid attention, and nobody is trying to give, nobody is trying explicitly to say that there should be more gray wolves, but there are more and more. And that's good for the world, especially this world.
So there are more and more gray hares, or more and more people wanting gray wolves?
Yeah, gray wolves.
Yeah.
And I won't tell you exactly how that works, but I can tell you I think this summer I figured, I read enough stuff to be convinced that the gray wolves are a keystone species. Beavers are in the Cascade Mountains, in quite a few places, but in not as near as many as before. As we think, mainly to do with us and humans, but we're not sure. But it's quite clear that beavers are some of the best keystone species there are on the planet. Wherever there are beavers, there are more of everything else. When the beavers go down in how many there are, all kinds of other things start going wrong. Weird, huh? Hummingbirds. There are hummingbirds in a... I took an extra week coming here to find out whether there were really hummingbirds in the Cascade Mountains, and I saw a whole bunch of them. And they are keystone species. We'll talk about that later. Well, of course, here's the thing that it took the longest this summer to think through, and that's grizzly bear. There's quite a bit of literature and even politics, as some of you may know, about grizzly bear in the Cascade Mountains. It turns out early on that there, people thought there might be like 2.5. In other words, hardly any left. But what they're finding out in history of the Cascades is there were a lot more. Some of you may know that the legislature here in Washington tried to say, let's get more grizzly bear, and lost. But They are keystone species. Wherever there are, despite humans' feelings about this, wherever the grizzly bear are, the rest of the populations are in much better shape. Despite the fact that the grizzlies are eating a few now and then.
Yeah.
Although probably more berries. Okay, so that's my project for this week, is for us spiritually to think through what it means for these keystone species to exist in our place, or maybe better, we exist in their place. Or maybe it doesn't have to be either or. But my sense spiritually, frankly, is that it would take some time for us to think through who we are if we want to say snowshoe hares, grizzly bear, beaver, hummingbirds matter. And maybe they matter at least as much or more than humans. How would we arrange to think clearly, spiritually, technically, politically about having a partnership with keystone species, or maybe having a world in which the keystone species really are key in the keystone in ways that we could take a little step backwards, or a different kind of step together. Remember those sea otters. There was a bit of something that happened that in which humans decided to be a part of the life of a keystone species, not to make more humans. Okay, I'd love to have protests, thoughts, questions. Yes?
So it reminds me of the other conversations that I've had with folks and things that I've read about bees.
Yes.
And can we survive without bees, mm-hmm. and the interaction of how we keep bees, all of that stuff. And so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And again, there's such a great big thing going on in biology about this all over the world. Mm-hmm. I'm going to focus mainly on this goofy Cascade Mountain thing, just because that's where we are.
I'm thinking about, when you're talking about the spirituality aspect of it, how much can we learn and garner from the native peoples? Because it seems to me that they probably have interacted in a spiritual and practical way with these key species you've identified, others too, I would think. But I know on, you know, growing up in the prairies of the Midwest, the buffalo, other species that were there for centuries, and when they disappeared, changes happened.
Yeah, almost certainly. I think so. Other thoughts? I love the protests, if we can get some of those things.
Sure, yeah. I get the the scientific and ecological and political aspects of this, but I was under the impression that this was a theological class, and I'm failing to understand how we ended up talking about trying to fix the environment here rather than
thank you.
What doesn't feel like doesn't feel like a spiritual discussion to me.
It will be a failure if that's the case for me. I think one of the ways that my politics and social politics are better is if my spiritual life asks the question, in this case, what value does God have in the animals, especially in this case, particular kind of animals? Yeah.
If I'm trying to relate it to like a human behavior, and I try to think of perhaps keystone species in humans, when you put this guy in the world doing this thing, you know, the effect that it can have on the overall world in general, you know, I can kind of, you know, relate it to that a little bit, I suppose.
Thanks. Yeah, that I think that's a nice answer to your own question to a certain extent. But I myself am convinced, theologically, and I'm a theologian, that the more we ask questions about the values of other creatures and of other mountains and the like, the closer we will get to God. Or I tend to like the word divinity, but we can use both. Thanks for that. If you come back, keep that question up or that protest. Thank you.
I'd like to say something about that. I see all of the wild lands as God's creation and a place where God is expressing God's abundance through it. And as much through them as through us.
Mm-hmm.
And so where we've done things that decrease certain species, especially these keystone species, I think we've worked against God's purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate you bringing these kind of up for us to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I think about God in all of those places that you just mentioned, I think also the thing that we have going with God in those places is agony, anger, and loss. In other words, I think God is feeling the agony, anger, and loss for God's connection to this huge part of being. I'm always knocking my microphone off there. Yes?
In regards to your last comment, I would argue that I think God can see has a lot of satisfaction in the fact that creation is so resilient, and the things that we go out of our way, not out of our way, that we impact very badly, still come back. So yes, we're continually threatening ecosystems in many ways, but you show by just reintroducing a few sea otters that it all comes back. It isn't a system that is destroyed forever.
Yeah.
And so to say God is feeling agony and whatever, maybe agony at his human creations who are doing this, but I think great satisfaction in the fact what nature does.
Mm.
And then one other thing I'll comment, two comments. I mean, when I grew up, you know, a long time ago, we didn't use the word keystone. We use the word key species. And beavers, of course, were a key species because they make the ponds and affects the ecosystem. I'm not going to get into that, but maybe you do. I don't. Everybody knows this. One of the things I've noticed in recent years is I've figured out some of the key species are the grazing animals that graze the shrubs. And you can start at the East Coast with the buffalo and the goats, which have been wiped out. You go to the Shenandoah, and you look at all of the stuff. And now we're just spraying like crazy to keep the shrubs down. You go to Iowa, the Lost Hills, I can talk about that. All of these grazing animals, buffalo, that were so important, because they graze shrubs. You think, a lot of us naively think that a grazing animal eats grass and leaves and flowers and all parts of the plant. Many of these animals are very specialized. With their stomachs and everything else, they only eat certain things. So it's a really complex web out there. And I know when I went to school, I learned these simplistic things about this does this and this does that. And it's kind of like it's only part of the story. And so what you're bringing up with Keystone is great because, I mean, it sort of forces people to think about all aspects of this stuff that interlocks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not knocking what you're saying.
No, well, I welcome Knox as well, but yes, thanks very much. I'm going to go to one more thought, and then I'm going to do a little bit on the Jubilee. I want to say one more thing, if you would. I've noticed that in the 13 times I've been to Holden, at least half of the times I've done the wrong thing that I did this morning, and that was not to ask for a mic for the rest of you. Especially, there have been six of us up top, and we can throw one to you all. So I apologize. Okay, so I'm going to switch, and I want to keep the mood and the character of asking the question, what is Jubilee? And I'm going to give a little overview about that and ask for some of your input as well. No, let me say one thing. When we began this preparation for this summer here at Holden, there was part of what we did early on that was led by Jewish people from Washington State. So this is what has been going on. This year, to ask what we can do, and there have been wonderful Jewish leaders that have helped us think through, and why would we want to have study on the Jubilee, which is, and let me, please forgive me for my the way I think about this, but I'm a Christian, and I'm a Christian theologian, and hardly anybody knows about the Jubilees in Christianity. If I'm offending someone, I apologize, but this is a ton of material in the First Testament. And in my Christian circles, which are rather large, I keep asking, I mean, since the beginning of this year, since I knew I was going to be on for the Jubilee, I kept asking Christians, hey, what do you think about the Jubilee? And they would just say, what? And there's just tons of really interesting things about the Jubilee that I think matter a lot with our colleagues and thought for this week. Similarly, by the way, since I have been, in addition to a professor of Christian theology, I've been 20 years of a professor for rabbis. And I ask them the same thing, and I only get a little bit more in the Jewish character that is even thinking a little bit about the First Testament and its powerful kind of thinking about the very earliest parts of the people of Israel. The word Jew doesn't come until a lot later, but is real important. So here's the first round that I would want to say. There's so much material in the First Testament about the Jubilee that it's all mixed up. There is not a clear, overarching approach to Jubilee. Now, Jubilee is a cultural practice that has a lot to do with God and religious people, and especially a lot to do with culture and sociology in the very earliest parts of the people of Israel. It looks like it was a very important way that the people of Israel treated the earth. The main thing on that was that there was a part of the Torah that said, you know what? You guys are off and running about having agriculture, but we're going to have an agreement that we have to leave the earth, and especially the growing earth, alone regularly, and don't plant anything. This is in one of the things we can say about the First Testament is that this thought is in 7-year periods. So that, in other words, the 7th year, stop it. Don't plant. Every 7th year, so that the earth can relax and not have so many people doing so many things to it. And then the other big thing that happens is 7 times 7. So there, you have to, in the 50th year, you have to really make sure at every turn there is grace and kindness going to not just people, but the earth itself. So the 50th year is a huge thing in the First Testament. Say, no, 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 no. Yes, 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 yes to a kind, gracious, and excited treatment of the earth. I mean, the commandments are amazing. There are some of these commandments, and they're kind of goofy in the way they're ordered, but they say the only thing in the 50th year you can do, and in some cases they say in the 7th year, is that you, the only thing that you are allowed to do with people in the land that you own is poor people. Let poor people do anything they want. not to build anything, but to go eat things around the edges. Similarly, there is a big divine deal going on in the text about who owns the earth. There's kind of an argument, frankly, in the First Testament about who owns the earth and who owns the land. But I would say it's about 57% of the text, I'm just making that up, 57% of the text say, oh, we know who owns the land. God. Very clearly, the texts say, you think you own it? No, you do not. And then there are the other texts that say, no, we do own it, but we're going to try to get together with God on how that works. So the beautiful thing that I propose for this week is that having a culture and a religion that places the relationship between the human and the earth is at the heart of who God is, of what divinity is in these texts. You know, just think about what that might be like if we followed the First Testament. My experience is that the people of Judaism now do think a lot more about that than my types. As my conversations with Judaism is they also think they are failing to pay attention to that. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a moment. Protests, thoughts, questions. The rest of the time this week is our job to look at these texts and to ask the same kind of questions as with the animals, and that is, how can we shift the character of our cultural, our feelings, our the way we organize ourselves, the earth?
I've never really talked with Jewish folks about Jubilee, and you have, which is good. I have a question. In any of their thinking, they talk about in the 7th year or the 50th year, you do some new planning and thinking about maybe going forward, what should you do? Because to me, it's one thing to market and say, at year 7 we do this, or at year 49 we do this. But if you're just not doing something, should there also then be planning what you really should do?
Oh, yeah. So
that'd be something positive to think about, as opposed to saying, oh, woe is us, we're just not doing the right things, but should we not think about doing something concrete?
For sure, thank you. I would just, because conversation with Jewish people is one of the hearts of my life. So I would say back that the thing that you were worrying about is there's a lot of people within Judaism that are really feeling that something has to be done the way you have said it. The decline of Christianity in America is almost exactly the same as the decline of Judaism in America. I have weekly conversations with my rabbi students and they sound almost like, well, not quite like the Lutherans, but they sound like Christian scholars, Christian clergy, and Christians in general about the despair of decline. So in other words, what should we do about this? What should we do about that? And so those are big questions.
Now, partially what I was asking, I may not have asked it very clearly because I'm not very articulate. Do the texts themselves ever talk about humans maybe thinking about this, as opposed to just following a rule, which to me is more like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, where every 7th year I do this, and 50th year I do this, okay. But is there anything more in any of the texts? That's sort of what I'm
saying. There is a lot more there, and there's a lot more pathos in those texts. Although that's really true of most of Torah. It's just that we Christians don't have sensitivities in that regard, and so I would say, pathos and good cheer, joy, is very much at the heart of what they're asking to do and doing. Let me say the first folly on that question, however, we have to talk about this, but what's happened in the last 40 years of study about Jubilee is whether there ever was one. I mean, there's so many texts in the First Testament about that, but none of them say, remember when we did that? and socio-cultural theologians have also noticed very clearly that that it is not at all clear that they could have done it in enormous parts of their history, partly because of the devastating things that happened to Israel, but more because of the complicated gains that the people of Israel made in what they thought humans should be doing. One of the things that is most clear is forgiveness is one of the biggest things about Jubilee. And that has to do not just with saying I'm sorry now and then, but has a lot to do with the way you handle money and the like. So anytime this week that we want to, we should say, oh, this doesn't matter at all because they never did it. The way I look at texts, both Christian and Jewish, is not so much that, because I think some of our best Christian and Jewish texts never happened, but are great.
There's a part of me that, having grown up on a farm in North Dakota, and the agronomy and at least early on with my grandparents and uncles and aunts and parents, the fallow, the time of letting the land sit, was just part of the natural rhythm.
Yeah.
And it was done, as economy has progressed over the last 40, 50 years, and the need to increase production and, you know, squeeze every ounce out of every piece, you could just see the topography change when people were breaking up prairie land, even on our farm, where there were wagon tracks and places where the native people, round circles like this where they used to camp, all of that kind of disappeared. But so that was one thing. And then the 7 year, I was thinking about the 7 days and the rest and the Sabbath as Jubilee as well. And I felt fortunate that in my household, my parents said, this is a day of rest. It was church, and then you do whatever you want to do. My brother and I were just talking about that the other day. You know, we spent the whole rest of Sundays fishing, riding motorcycles, riding horses, just playing. And they rested and visited and whatever. Even when there was storms coming in that could destroy the crop the next day, Dad refused to get out of the combine and get that last 40 acres off. He said, "This is Sabbath. This is rest day. This is Jubilee." And use those words. But
That's really lovely. This is the last thing I'm going to say technically, because it's 10 o'clock. But I want you to know that I like talking about this all day long. So grab me anytime you want. And I always hang around afterwards to continue conversation. But one other thing, Jewishly and as Israel, is yet on the table here. And that is a really important, underrated Jewish holiday coming up. And that's Sukkot, which is at the heart of doing this. If you don't know what Sukkot is, come and tell me afterwards, but this is basically a way of stopping in the middle of a whole period of time and building a tent outside and just hanging out there for about 8 days. It's an extended Shabbat. I'll probably tease you a little bit by the end of the week as to whether, we might think about Sukkot this week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.